This is January the 13th, 1950, Fall First Morning Lecture. This morning we have the problem of knowing this. Now, when you know all there is to know about knowing this, why, you'll know all there is to know, of course. And that isn't just a wisecrack, that's fact. You know all there is to know about knowing this, you'd all know all there is to know. You see, once upon a time you were bored because you knew everything there was to know. So you began to invent things which you wouldn't know. And began to throw in automaticities which would prevent you from knowing. And the first automaticity that prevents you from knowing is space. The moment you put down the barrier of space and you say you're in one place and something else can be in another place, you thereupon, thereby, and at that moment, of course, do not know what is at that other point of space unless you look. So the first major cut down of knowingness is lookingness. But there's another method which really doesn't actually belong on this scale, but which can be included on this scale just for our use, and that's beingness. You decided to be something that didn't know. And this actually was your first requirement, obviously. All right, is it a good job? Yes, it's a good job because it gives you a lot of things you don't know. That's a good job. So, beingness actually flickers around above and below lookingness as a system of not knowing. Beingness is a system of not knowing. Lookingness is a system of not knowing. Emotingness is a system of not knowing. Effortingness is a system of not knowing. Thinkingness is the best I know of for not knowing. Symbolizingness is a system for not knowing, and that thing which is packed with the most surprises, both for the eaten and the eater, is, of course, eatingness. And then sexingness, of course, is a tremendous adventure on the subject of not knowingness. And people go around and be sad all up and down this line because they don't know. Well, now, this is a wonderful thing because they've fixed the line all the way up from top to bottom so they won't know. Now, you come along as an auditor and you want this fellow to know. Obviously, he's cut his knowingness level down to a below tolerance. And he's gotten down to a point where he doesn't know that he doesn't know about a lot of things. But mostly, he doesn't know that not knowingness has a value. Because he's down so low on the knowingness scale by the time he gets around to being audited that his life is full of not surprises, but anxieties. And what is an anxiety but another surprise? Too many surprises all in a row gives an anxiety. Now, when we say randomness, we're saying predictingness. Well, let's add up predictingness and knowingness and find out that the two are quite similar. If you had no time at all, if you were just floating in a span of time which was all the same time, well, there's certainly no problem of knowingness there. You just investigate the thing and then you know all about it. It's not going to change any. You have to enter in this thing called motion into time before you get a not knowingness. When motion gets into time, you have then a system of not knowingness because you have a system of predictingness. And you might say that the time track is rigged by you, by nobody else, to make it possible for you to not predict. Not to make it possible for you to predict. Otherwise, you would be in just a static state of utter boredom. There would be nothing to duplicate because you duplicated everything. There'd be nothing to not know because you knew everything. And there would be nothing to do. And there would be nothing to have because you'd have everything. And so we paint this rather dismal picture of the individual who knew all there was to know. It is a dismal picture. Unless knowing everything would bring about a condition of no boredom. If this possibility exists, all right. But once you've entered upon a motioningness, boredom is an inevitable consequence. You know, once in a while you get somebody who's rammed around the world, and he can look back to his 16, 18, 20-year-old days as a beautiful panorama of surprises and not knowingnesses, going over the ranges and finding on the other side an enormous difference. And when he gets along a little further, why, he has a slight change. He looks over the hill, down into the dale. He knows what he'll find there. So after a while, he doesn't even bother to go and look. And the years drift on drearily, up to the time when he can get into an agreed-upon not-knowingness state, such as death. And he gets into a completely not knowing the state so that he can take a new jump off into the adventure of not knowing. And he can go around as a little baby and pull things over on himself and not know that they were going to hit him. He can go around in the front yard and pat vicious dogs on the head and not know he's going to be bitten. And life is very bright and life is full of lots of surprises. But the villain of yesteryear was generally painted up as being a rather cold, calculating individual who calculated exactly right the point of and moment of collision of two particles or when they were going to be parted. And this was supposed to be very villainous. Well, that's sort of another mechanism to prevent you from not knowing. Because the truth of knowingness, when applied to motion, is the ability to predict the coincidence or non-coincidence or courses and directions of two or more particles. The estimation of effort then becomes, in terms of motion, knowingness. And the estimation of effort is an all. When it comes to time, so on. An individual who has lost track of time has lost track of his estimation of effort, of course. Now you can go through the simple exercise of putting somebody in possession of skill in estimating the coincidence of particles, two particles coming together, at what moment they're going to come together, or at what moment they're going to part, and find out that you will increase his self-respect, his dignity, and all those other things which we value. That's an oddity, isn't it? Let's take a bunch of militiamen. And when they fire, why, sometimes they hit the leaves of the trees overhead. Sometimes they shoot off the toe of their boot. When you say squad's right, they go to the rear. When you say charge, they go to the rear. Their camp's dirty, their uniforms are worse. And then we train them into being able to predict the coincidence of two particles, a bullet and a man. We train them into being able to commit evolutions on a parade ground. And we find out they get so darn cocky that they'll go ahead and get killed any day of the week. We have obviously taken some of the liability out of existence simply by training them into knowing what particles are going to be at what point. Confidence adds up to this in terms of motion. Totally adds up to this in terms of motion. Knowing when two particles will coincide or not coincide. Knowing the courses of particles and their coincidences. That's confidence. Unconfidence or lack of confidence, fear or anxiety, has to do only with this. Not knowing when and where two particles will coincide, what direction they take. And so we get in the entire pattern of motion predictingness. And when we say prediction, we mean simply that, the time and place of coincidence or non-coincidence of particles and the courses they will pursue. That's all. We don't mean anything more than that. As long as you stay within these definitions, you're in very good shape. As soon as you exceed these definitions in auditing, you get into horrible shape. You chase off and start processing druidism out of the girl, and you start processing free association, and you get bewildered, and you wondered why the techniques don't work, and the next thing you wind up is the only thing you have to show for your auditing probably is a little intercourse along the line. That's about a crude statement, but it happens to be a very descriptive statement of psychotherapy in the past. This isn't what we're trying to do. We're trying to predict the coincidence of particles or their non-coincidence. Therefore, opening procedure has a value considerably in advance of what you immediately suppose. I know that opening procedure does not appear to be a very beefy technique. I know that. It appears to be something that's very mild and innocent and so forth. Well, that's because it hasn't been done with the complete viciousness that it can be done. Because the one thing that it hits at and hits toward is one of the first things that turns up in a session where opening procedure is being well used. The moment you start to hit a point where the individual is actually going to predict exactly where he's going to go and what he's going to do, you're liable to kick on the original machine which he installed in order to prevent himself from being bored another 18 million years. And so he feels very shortly like he's going to scream his head off. Now, the terrific confusion of most banks does not happen to admit this plain, clear picture of if you are able to predict the coincidence of particles or their non-coincidence, you will be bored. This is not evident. It doesn't meet the eye. The person does not know that. You see, he hasn't a clear plot of his own bank. It's just a big scramble of, well, it's like a government. You know how a government is planned? Well, they plan a government by saying there's going to be a government, and then they start adding to it. And they add a bureau to a department, and then find out that that is overloaded, and without knocking it out at all, they put in another bureau. And then without knocking that out, why, they put in a department to care for the functions which the first two bureaus should have cared for but aren't caring for, but they aren't out of existence. They're still functioning. And when they find this doesn't work, why, then the president or somebody appoints a special committee to perform the same function, now having two bureaus, a department already performing that function. Now we've got a special committee performing the same function. And these are working without any coordination or attention from anybody. and they keep falling over each other and making a mad scramble of paper chains that run over the hills and into the Treasury Department, usually. Now, this is a plan. This is what is laughingly called organized government. That's merely because man is very sloppy. His knowing this is too low for him to lay out a workable plan. He knows that he has to have experience in order to have a workable plan. This he knows better than anything else, and it happens to be a lie. He could lay out a perfectly workable government, put it into action, and let it roll. No great trouble with it. The only trouble is it would take first some thought and then some planning and then a little effort. And of these, he's not very capable. Well, you're looking actually at the bank of the Preclear when you're looking at this picture of the government. He set up a bureau in order to function in some department, and then he set up another bureau, and he set up a department, and then he set up a committee. Well, what happened here is actually at first he wasn't bored. What happened was that some very surprising incident occurred, so he set up a machine to police it. He didn't want that to happen again. So he set up a machine to police it, and then he didn't trust that machine because his randomity increased immediately that he installed a machine. You know, you start running. There's nothing like this system for getting scared. Start running. That's the most wonderful system for getting scared I know of. So start running. Not of anything. If you don't believe this, take Preclear down in the corner of the street someday. And you say, now look, we're going to conduct a little experiment. I want you to start running down that way as though something were after you. He'll start running. Before he's gone a quarter of a block, he'll be sure something's after him. Well, what do? You just kick in one of these machines, that's all. Or you just kick in a basic randomity. Everything must have a reason, is the motto of a machine. Everything has a reason. So if he finds out that he is running, then there must be a reason for it. So he supplies the reason. And so he has conducted all of his activities. He tries to balance everything he is doing against a reason for doing it. The reason is always after the fact. He may think afterwards that it was before the fact, but there's nothing quite as silly as a fellow trying to explain what he was doing last night in terms of why. Now, he can tell you what he was doing last night as just an account of motion of particles, events. But if you sat there and started, if you really wanted to butcher him, you'd keep asking him why he did it. And you know, he'd explain the whole thing to you. He'd just explain it down to the last notch, down to the last broken beer glass. It'd be all explained. But he explains always after the fact. Well, he only explains if he feels he doesn't know. He throws reason into the breach for failures to accurately predict. He throws reason in there. Didn't predict, he explains why. Did you ever run into somebody who insisted on explaining why to you that he wasn't driving a Lincoln or a Cadillac or something? Did you ever run into somebody who did that? Or explain why she was wearing last year's hat. And this person would keep on explaining why this was taking place. If you just listen, they would go on for a year or two with no other topic of conversation than explaining why. Well, they're trying to explain away a failure. A failure, basically, is not predicting this, which is, of course, not knowing this. They didn't know it was going to happen. Well, they'll explain to you, well, the reason you're wearing last year's hat is a very simple reason. You see, husband, you know, he was the general manager of the PepsiCo plant and so on. And if it hadn't been for one of his bosses there, you know, a fella had it in for him, couldn't stand the man's talent, you know. And here we go in these long involved explanations as to why. Well, they're trying to know after the fact. Now, there is another mechanism of not knowing this. Know afterwards. And everybody pursues this one to some degree. They know afterwards. And then they add this up, finally, to believe that it is a valuable thing to know afterwards. There is absolutely no value in knowing afterwards. Because the only accident a piece of knowledge will prevent is the accident which it should have prevented. It won't prevent the second accident to amount to anything. Because the second accident is going to happen in some other fashion. So we just have to keep throwing in ironclad arbitraries, and we finally come down to the only thing that will prevent an accident. And every armed force, every bureau, every insurance company comes down to the final conclusion: no motion. This is the method of preventing an accident. And if you add up all of the reasons why, you'll find out they all add up to no motion. The reasons why. We must prevent this series of accidents. The reason why we have had accidents in the past, that people walk past this point without their tin hats on. All right, people after this are not going to walk past this point. Well, first they're going to walk past this point with their tin hats on, then they find out that they can't do that because the supply department isn't issuing tin hats. So they don't let people walk past that point. Now they've had an accident someplace else, so they won't let people walk past that point. Now they've had an accident someplace else, and they say whoever handles tin bars after this has got to wear gloves. But there aren't enough gloves to go around, so after a while they figure out that the best way to handle tin bars is in another shop someplace. So they have to handle tin bars in some highly specified way, and they're, in other words, introducing more and more particles into the coincidence of the first two particles. And they're getting more and more places where people can't go and more kinds of motions which people can't do. Now, you say it's very, very laudable, extremely laudable, this terrific safety campaign which they run in the American public school to prevent little children from being run over at the crosswalks. You say, that's just wonderful. The hell it is. It's teaching them to have accidents. It's making them close terminals with accidents, making them accident-conscious, and will turn out more accident-prone than you can count. Well, what's basically wrong with this? Well, it interferes with their survival. It interferes, again, with the survival of the fittest, going back to Darwin. And now, let me point out to you something. I was one time in the Philippines. I was going through some sawgrass and what they call a sperramomento, several sperramomento thickets. Sperramomento, they're a thorn bush which has its barb growing backwards. And it's like fish hooks. And when you walk by, they almost take your arm off, you know. And thorns go the wrong way, too. Well, it's impossible to get through these things, everybody knows, and through sawgrass, that cuts you to ribbons. I was proceeding with the greatest of caution and with considerable work on the part of a machete when all of a sudden a little brown Igorote boy was standing in front of me. I wondered how he got there, because he obviously hadn't come in over the trail. Here was a particle which I hadn't predicted. So he wanted to show me the way over to the village because he said I was off course. And he said, follow me. And he went away from there at a dead run. Straight through. It's the most fantastic job of broken field running. Why, I tell you, the Philadelphia Eagles would have paid that little kid more money. And he went through those bushes, zip, 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 bring, bang. He was walking straight through and running straight through these thorn bushes and everything. And not a single thorn was hitting him. Not a scratch on him. I was cut to ribbons. I never have gotten adventurous enough to try the same thing, but he taught me a big lesson. And that is to say, the speed of the prediction of a particle is what prevents an accident. Not less particles. Now, you go out on the line of less particles and you're in trouble. Because you can cut down somebody's having this, and then he compulsively has, and so forth. Now, let's not worry about that. Let's not worry about how many particles there are around. Let's not worry about how many teenagers are driving at 90 miles an hour down the streets. Let's not worry how many crosswalks people don't pay any attention to. Because the second we start worrying about that, we're trying to stop motion. When you stop motion, you make people sick. You make them unhappy, and you take out of existence the essential element of competence. You make it unnecessary for them to predict the coincidence of particles. and there's no other game. So these boys who put up these big safety signs, safety slogans, and so forth are doing a wonderful job of what? Of making a totally incompetent society in terms of motion. As the years roll along, these drivers will get worse and worse, and these kids will have more and more accidents. And the cops will care less and less. And they'll go down to a point where nobody is able to prevent being hit. Now, what you want are a bunch of little school kids that can step out directly in the path of a speeding ambulance, which is going 80 miles an hour down a residence district street, and have the ambulance go on by without touching the child. Now, that's what you want. The only way to be safe in this universe is to be able to handle motion in space with enormous competence. And the only way to be happy, if you're going to have anything to do with motion, is handle it. Don't try to stop it. As soon as you start stopping motion, you are admitting that you don't know which way it's going to go, and therefore are in a state of apathy concerning its course. So you say, we can't have motion. Well, believe me, perception itself is the interchanges of particles. If you can't handle motion, you can't see. Isn't that interesting? So let's train everybody up in reverse. Let's train everybody up to have stop particles. Well, that's about as far from no training as you can get. You finally turn out a society which is worse than the militia. You never have to train the militia if there's never any war. Well, someday, somebody will add up the accident tolls. I can see the article now in Collier's in the year 1988. Are we killing our children? The society which today sits around in wheelchairs at the age of 10. You start making people afraid of motion, you start making them sick. Real sick. Now, you could say that this is a contest between motion and all-knowingness. All-knowingness would presuppose a zone in which there was no motion. Nearly all knowingness would presuppose an ability to predict the future positions consecutively of all particles. And if you stop and think of the complexity of that picture, predict the future positions of all particles. We don't say for how long. Let's predict the future positions for all particles in this universe for the next million years. I tell you, you're getting up there. That's really straining at it. Because in the first place, motion itself is there to produce randomity. And if you have put all knowingness as a possibility above all particles and their positions, this is really straining at it. Because you have too much and too many, and you yourself not willing to predict the courses of particles that thoroughly. Because that courts no action, no motion, and actually no thinkingness. What do you have to think for if you know? It would leave you with absolutely no interest in anything. You never have any interest in anything. Why should you be interested in anything? You could predict everything. And this is a horrible state of affairs. As a matter of fact, if you don't believe this, put somebody in a room that has some motion in it. Let's say we have a couple of little air blowers in there that throw ping pong balls around in a very, very standard pattern. You know, the ping pong balls are always going to go in that pattern. Like you see in vacuum cleaner store windows once in a while. Well, you just put this person in that room and have him sit there. You give him adequate light. It's warm. It's comfortable. You give him food. You don't give him anything to read, though, or any other randomity production mechanisms. and just let him sit there and watch the ping pong balls. He knows where they're going to go. He knows that ping pong ball, when it goes up into the air, is going to describe this little elliptical curve. It's going to come back down again, roll down this little chute, and it's going to go into the top of the machine. It's going to go up in the air again, go up this elliptical curve. It's going to go up down the chute. It's going to go back into the air spot again, and it's going to go up in the air, perform an elliptical curve, and ball after ball is going to do this. They're going to do this in a nice parade. Now, if you were to play a random color machine on it, so that they would turn green and turn blue and turn yellow and mauve and colors would mix and that sort of thing, the person could sit there quite fascinated for quite a while. Why? All he has there is the random shift of color, you see. It's the one thing which he is able to find that is random. But we don't give him any random shift of color. He just watches the ping pong balls. By golly, after a while, if he isn't crazy, he'll sure feel like he's going to be. He's sitting there. He's doing nothing. There's nothing to predict at all, because everything is predicted. He knows what's going to happen to these ping pong balls. The only thing that could possibly happen would be somebody turned off the juice and kept the air from blowing there so that the ping pong balls would stop. And if you kept him sitting there for a year, that fellow, before many months were out, would just be begging for some accident to occur to stop the ping pong ball. There is madness. Madness could be said to be a tightrope walk between all-knowingness and no-knowingness. An individual is trying to escape the inevitable consequences of knowing everything and trying to escape the inevitable consequences attendant on knowing nothing. And when he is either position, knowing everything and knowing nothing, we have madness. So we've got actually the Theta Mess theory in terms of sanity. Now, you want to make a test of this sometime. If you want to, just make a little test of this. I can see some of you uncomfortable thinking about it right now. Does it make you uncomfortable thinking about that? Well, the state decides the criminal has too much motion in him. And instead of gearing up the cops, you know, that isn't, by the way, an unreasonable solution. You know, the criminals are pretty active these days, so we just gear up the cops. You know, get cops that can move instead of cops that hold motion. The criminal, by the way, works for most of the newspaper syndicates without pay. What the society would do without some good, solid, mean, wicked criminals, I don't know. British tabloids there, very, very much to the point. They couldn't even come out. Nobody would pay any attention to them if it wasn't for the daily work of this unthanked entertainer who belongs to no unions but goes on day in and day out doing his task for society by amusing it, holding up trains and so forth. It's hard work, too. But the society takes this fellow after his great labors, after his tremendous public contribution via the newspapers, and puts him in a cage and lets him sit there. That's real great. That's real great. Now they expect this fellow's going to be saner afterwards. Well, they've taken a fellow from a little bit too much motion. They've tried to crowd him down to no motion so as to slow him down a little bit. And you know, they can't quite get through their heads how tough man really is. Because every time they throw him in the jail, it merely convinces him further that society has committed an overt act against him, so he now has a motivator. So he can go out and spend it. Because he merely bottles up all the motion he'd love to do and goes out and performs it. Now, he does this up to a certain point, at which time his honesty doesn't crack on, his sanity cracks off, and he goes stir-crazy. And what we know as stir-crazy is just the simple problem of sitting still day in and day out with nothing to do but think and nothing to look at and no randomity. You know when the guard is going to come by. You know when the food is going to go through. The most wonderful story, there is an author in this modern age, believe it or not, there is a real writer. His name's Manuel Komarov. He is the least sung writer for his ability, I think, of modern times. That's mainly because he can write. Some of his stories are wonderful. But they get buried. Once in a while, some college professor damns one of Manuel Komaroff's stories utterly by putting it in an anthology. Well, anybody who gets in an anthology, of course, never gets read. He's done in. But Manuel Komaroff's material, I don't think, is adequately collected. Because I read a little book, story of his one time in Esquire, of all places. How junky can you get in magazines? Esquire. But here's a Manuel Komaroff story in there. And it's about a fellow who had just got through spending 20 years in prison, something like that, and he's been sent home. He gets home, and he finds out, little by little, they're really his friends. You know, that his boy and family will take care of him. He's pretty old by this time. He's a real old man. So he gradually makes over the room they give him, and it's a little bit too big, you know. The closet's dangerous because there might be mice in there. And he gets that space cut down a little bit, and finally he surreptitiously and covertly manages to get some bars across the window, and he fixes the thing up, and once in a while somebody will appear on the roof of the building next door that will look like a guard, and so forth, and he's finally pretty happy about it, and he just settles down. That is a real chiller, that story. Very calmly written. Now, this is the inevitable consequence of somebody in a trap called the mesh universe, really. He predicts no motion. He keeps him boxed up, keeps him in a groove. After a while, he starts running real slow and begins to live on Earth. Now, you ought to change your sights on speed. How fast can an individual move? Well, let's take an example right here on Earth. This little Igorodi boy, at a dead run, he can go through these Sparamomento thickets and sawgrass. White men cut him to pieces. And there must be a terrific ability there to see particles and plot the coincidence of his body and brush and things like that and get through holes that would not be observable. Think of the tremendously narrow margin he's running on. He never gets scratched. All right, a trained motorcycle rider is an interesting point. I saw a mechanic the other day in a motorcycle shop test out a machine. And he just tested out this machine to find out if the motor was going to run. It didn't occur to this fellow he's doing anything very spectacular, but there are about four machines parked. Well, now, obviously, for the routine rider, there was no way to get out from amongst these four machines because they were parked in at random, you see, in front of him. You'd had to have sat on this motorbike that was being tested and then back it for a little distance, you know, and then turn it sideways and work it around and worm it around and so forth. Obviously, that was the course. This fellow sat on the saddle of the motorbike, started his motor, threw it in gear, threw it in low, and cracked the throttle on full and appeared out in the street. He didn't turn aside. I think his margin between himself, there might have been an eighth of an inch clearance, but on about four consecutive turns. He got out in the street, he ran around the block, he brought it back in, and he found out he couldn't park it without working it around at a great rate, you know. He wasn't trying to be spectacular. He never saw such a staid expression on anybody's face. Nobody was watching him. And he came in back of the four machines and cracked his throttle on full so as to skid the rear wheel and turned 180, parked the motorcycle. Front brake on full, you see, the front wheel just stopped moving and the rear wheel skidded all the way around to make 180 degrees, and then he kicked on the props, kickstand, you know, and got off the thing. Said he'd have to adjust its carburetor. Now, this is just a prediction of particles, that's right. How much space, where are the particles, and where are the particles going to meet, and where aren't they going to meet, and so forth. Done as an observed calculation. Don't think anybody can get automatic and do this. It's not done automatically. It's done by looking. And it's done by knowing and looking. Well, let's take space opera. You can turn people on the E-meter and find out they've been in something they call space opera. All right, how fast is space opera? Don't kid yourself. You couldn't live in space opera with your Earth training here. As a matter of fact, That's one of the things that bows down a lot of your pre-clears, girls and guys. They've been in space out there. They know how fast it can move. They know how quick it can happen. And you'll find them parked at times when they were wrong. Well, how wrong were they? They're not very wrong. Things happen an awful fast. Well, that is a tolerable speed of motion. Barely tolerable for the psyche, actually. Now, what your Thetan struggles against, all the time he's talking, he wants peace, he says. He doesn't want peace, he wants action. Peace is death. And a desire for peace is the final surrender to the apathy of having lost and knowing you're in jail. You're saying, I'm not dangerous anymore. Let's not anybody else be dangerous either. Let's have peace. There is no such thing as peace in this universe. It's a love-hate universe. If you can't love passionately and hate passionately, you're unhappy. Now, in patching together Preclair, you have to take it into consideration that his motion and his ability to predict motion has been cut way, 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 way down. And when you take exteriorization into account, you find out consistently and continually that your person who exteriorizes least ably, who gets the mock-ups least well, is the person who has the most automatic systems to predict the coincidence of particles. And who is doing a rather poor job of predicting their coincidence. Now, you can get improvement in your pre-clear simply by taking him out on an athletic field and putting him in a fast game. Not football or baseball or tiddlywinks or some other game. I mean a fast game like lacrosse. Or the Cubans play a game down there that rather defies the eye. There are some fast games here on Earth. But very few people can move fast enough to play them. It's wonderful that football and baseball draw the crowds they play. Nine men standing around loafing on bases. One particle to predict a baseball. One other particle to predict a bat. Oh, this is... I mean, this is murder. Anybody in his right mind who would go look at a baseball game and pretend he was really interested... You know, it's a funny thing, though. People are able to go to those games. But, you know, they really don't like Bush League games. They like big games, big team games. Well, I found out why one day. I went and saw one of the big league games by accident. And I thought they were going to play something there. Anyway, but I did see it, and I was impressed. For I saw a quintuple play. Which was just fantastic. You know, a triple play is three outs, but this is, I merely mean that particle hit five places. It hit them accurately, it departed from them accurately. You never saw such a machine go into action in your life. Zing, zing, bing, bing, bang. The guy was out. And boy, everybody was right on the qui vive. Well, these big league boys are on the qui vive. They really can predict that particle. And it's a joy to behold, but the trouble is they're so confident in predicting the particle, and the game itself is so... natively slow, that you never really get a chance for much action. The pitcher stands up there and fans out the batter. The pitchers are too good, and so forth. The game isn't fast enough. That's about the main criticism you could make of it. But here is competence in terms of your pre-clear. Your pre-clear here on Earth gets himself all geared up to be tremendously competent. And then there's nothing to be competent about. You know, he goes to the office and he sits down at a desk and there's no predicting that particle. I mean, it's just going to sit there. And the pieces of paper come in and what do they do to him? Well, now let me tell you an interesting little gimmick about communication, something you're going to have to do to some executive sometime or another as a process, and it's going to butcher him. Get pieces of paper coming in front of his face saying uniformly, you've got to take care of it over there yesterday. Piece of paper after piece of paper after piece of paper. All they're telling him, any piece of paper that he gets in his hand, any message he gets in his hand, is going to tell him, essentially, not something is going to happen unless something is done, but it will tell him, in the low-geared society we're in, something has already happened about which you didn't do anything. So every piece of paper he's gotten makes him wrong. And the more pieces of paper, the less right he is. If you wanted a business to really run, you would probably wipe out the desks. You wouldn't let anybody have a desk. Actually, it's better than nothing to have an accurate paper chain and a fast paper chain moving. But really, a business would run better if there was no paper chain. The guy on the ground had to take the responsibility. You know, he couldn't sit back and say, well, I wrote the main office about it last week, and although the derrick fell down today, why, I've been waiting for them to send somebody out to bolster it up. We couldn't do it. No responsibility, no responsibility, no responsibility. That's how things fall to pieces. Well, anyway, the guy on the ground is the only fellow who can predict the particle, of course. Now, what's this all add up to in terms of process? Well, I just gave you one. It's a piece of paper in front of his face that says, it's wrong over that way yesterday. Another piece of paper is wrong over that way yesterday. Another piece of paper is wrong over that way yesterday. It's wrong over that other direction yesterday. And he'll get right back to one of the earliest Thetan versus Thetan engrams there is, which one Thetan took a big gob of blackness and smashed it across the other Thetan's mock-up's face. So the mock-up didn't know where it was. So it didn't predict that particle, and it suddenly lost, and it can't quite figure out why it so suddenly lost. Because it was depending upon sight, and it isn't seeing now. So it's lost. So it's wrong over that way. All right. I want you now to put up into the front wall of the room the postulate or thought or symbol, however you want to get it there, and the emotion, I didn't know. Now put it over in the right wall of the room. The left wall of the room. Now the ceiling. Now the back of the room. Now put it in the front wall of the room and make it flinch. I didn't know flinch. The right wall of the room, I didn't know flinch. The left wall of the room, ditto. The back wall of the room, the ceiling, forget that flinch, the floor. The space in front of the building, I didn't know flinch. The space in back of the building. The space at the right side of the building. The space at the left side of the building. The space above the building, and the space under the building. Okay, now get somebody else, get the idea that somebody else puts into the front wall, I didn't know, flinch. Get that flinch. Somebody else put it in. The left wall. Somebody else putting in it, I didn't know, flinch. The right wall. the back wall. The ceiling. The floor. All right, now let's have somebody else putting I didn't know flinch into the space above the building. The space back of the building. Space to the right of the building. Space to the left of the building. Space below the building. And in the space of the room. Okay, now get the idea of somebody else making somebody else. Not know and flinch. In the front wall. In the back wall. In the right wall. In the left wall. In the floor. In the ceiling. Somebody else making somebody else not know and flinch. In the space in front of the building. The space in back of the building. The space to the right of the building. The space to the left of the building. The space above the building. The space below the building. In the space of this room. And you put, for somebody else, in the front wall, I didn't know, flinch. In the back wall. In the right wall. In the left wall. In the ceiling. In the floor. In the space in front of the building. In the space back of the building. In the space to the right of the building. In the space to the left of the building. In the space below the building. In the space above the building. Now have somebody putting for you in the front wall, I didn't know, flinch. The back wall. The right wall. The left wall. The ceiling. The floor. In the space in front of the building. The space to the right of the building. The space to the left of the building. Space below the building. Space above the building. Okay. I have somebody else put for himself in the front wall. I didn't know flinch. In the back wall. In the ceiling. In the floor. In the space in front of the building. In the space to the right of the building. Space to the left of the building. Space above the building. Space below the building. Now, having put it in you, now have you put it in somebody else? Have somebody else put it in somebody else? Have you put it in yourself? Have somebody else put it in himself? Now put it out there in front of you four times. I didn't know flinch. Get that flinch. And duplicate it. You can only get one or two. You'll build up to four. Duplicate it. Duplicate it. Duplicate it. Duplicate it. Duplicate it. I got it real good this time. Duplicate that. Now say you're going to put it there and put it there. Now say you're going to put it there and put it there. And duplicate that action. And duplicate it again. And duplicate it again. Now throw away any mock-ups you have there. And let's put the first time you discovered you didn't know out in front of you four times and have it flinch. And duplicate it. And continue to duplicate it. Duplicate it some more. Now duplicate it and each time let go. Say you're going to put it there. Put it there four times. Say you're going to let go and then let go. And then duplicate it all over again. All right, sweep all those mock-ups away. Now, any automaticity, any strange thing, tears, laughter, or anything else that has shown up while you're doing this, duplicate it. And continue to duplicate it.